Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Depending on where you live in the United States, you might describe your weekend getaway differently. Here in Wisconsin, you might head up to your cottage, or maybe it's your cabin. That's how people in Minnesota generally refer to it. In the Northeast, places like Maine and the Adirondacks, people talk about going to their camp.
Whatever you call it, that place of retreat comes with a certain state of mind and often a certain architecture. Both of those aspects are of particular interest to writer and architect Dale Mulfinger. Mulfinger has designed cabins that are now along lakes and in the woods in Wisconsin and Minnesota. He's also author of the new book, The Family Cabin, and he joins us on the line from his office in Minneapolis. Welcome to the show.
Great, Mitch. It's good to be here and happy to chat about cabins, one of my favorite subjects.
So when you look at the cabins in this book, they are all different shapes and sizes, and they're situated in different places. What holds cabins together under the definition of cabin in your eyes?
A couple things. I think one is they tend to be in places that attract us even before we put a structure on them. So whether they're at the water's edge or on a mountaintop or looking out over a broad prairie, they tend to be in somewhere that we want to go to. And then after that, they tend to be a structure that, even if it's larger in scale, tends to focus on the common areas. Because in a cabin, we're not going to spend much time in our bedroom. We're going to spend time with people or we'll be outdoors. So they are places where bonding can occur and is promoted. And you might be sleeping on the couch in a cabin as opposed to in a bedroom. Or they have lofts because we want to be able to hear the people who are still chatting away downstairs as we go to bed at night. So they definitely permeate a certain kind of character about them.
There's a certain state of mind that goes into it.
Very much so. When you go to the cabin, you're often feel as though you're getting away from something, whatever that might mean for you, getting away from your hectic life or the life that you might have in your professional world and where you live in the suburbs of the city. And so you're trying to get to this other place where all of a sudden hearing the loons every night takes you, in a direction that wasn't the case when you were in the city.
As I was getting ready for this interview, I was jotting down some notes, and the idea of, having your real personality come out when you're at a place like a cabin was one of the things I put down on paper.
I think that certainly a different part of you comes out. Which one of them is real, I don't know. But, whether you're out fishing or hiking or stargazing at night because all of a sudden you can see the stars because you're not in the city lights. All of those things bring out a different side of who you are and what interests you. And you might have, if you go with people to their cabin, you might have never known that they were, in addition to being the person you knew, they're also a hunter or a trekker or something in that life they have at the cabin.
So as an architect and as an architect who designs cabins, how does the process of working with someone to design a space like this differ from how you might approach other projects?
Well, I, as an architect, do projects for people in the city, and whether that be an additional remodeling or a new home, and then also do cabins in sites that are here in the Midwest. They're commonly found on lakes or rivers. And when we do those projects, I think one of the notable differences is that most people who have an extra dollar to build a place at the water's edge will often think of that as a legacy project. That is to say, they're not going to make their decisions based on resale. They're going to make their decisions based on they expect that their child is likely to inherit that, or children are likely to inherit that. So they're able and willing to put more personality into the structure than they would at their house in the city. So in the house in the city, they're going to every so often say, well, is that going to resell? And they rarely ever say that for their cabin location. So that's a big difference. So the other difference is they're not going to put so much emphasis on sleeping spaces. Yes, they need a place to sleep. Yes, they might want some privacy there. But they're not going to dwell on in bedroom. They're going to dwell in the common areas of the cabin.
I was really struck by, you mentioned this, the loft designs in some of the cabins in this book, the idea being that they're apart from the common areas, but they're sort of connected to them enough that you still feel, you know, especially if you're a child going to bed upstairs in the loft, that you're connected with the stuff that's going on downstairs.
Yes, we have a loft in our cabin, and we thought initially, it's quite a small loft. We thought initially when children went to sleep up there, they would have a hard time falling asleep with us chatting down below them. And what we found is they actually fall asleep much quicker in a loft than they do if you store them away in the bedroom and close the door, where they might have some fear or who knows why it is. But hearing the calm banter of adults actually helps them fall asleep. So I think there is a sense of connectedness, of intimacy in a cabin that's important. And even, we think of possibly sleeping in the same bedroom as other adults, and we don't think too much of that in a cabin. We just accept the fact that it occurs. I have taught for quite a bit at the University of Minnesota, and I often say that the cabin is the only place I've ever slept with my dean. And I slept in a loft, and his wife and my wife were in the middle of the bed, and he and I were on the outer edges of the bed. And you know, you do that at a cabin, you'd never think of doing that even in a motel room.
There are a number of cabins in this book that are off the grid, and I imagine the owners of these places are very much on the grid in their day-to-day life. How do you balance, you know, designing a place that has modern amenities with the idea that it ought not to be just like the house that a cabin owner has left behind?
A lot of people want to downscale the technologies. When they get to a cabin, they want a more primitive sense of their existence there, so they may not feel that they need TV screens or computer screens, for that matter. I know when I go to my cabin, we kind of allude to the fact that there are no screens in our cabin. There are to keep the bugs out, but not the other kind of screens. And I think people like getting away from that interconnectedness with everything. I often enjoy the fact that I really don't pay too much attention to the news when I'm at the cabin, although I do often turn on the radio to hear the news, but I don't have a television there, and I don't miss it. So I think people enjoy that, and some people are more significantly off-grid in the sense that they're not connected to an electrical system that is a collective system anyway. They may have a few solar panels to drive something. Most people will still have some form of, say, gas appliance, whether that be a gas refrigerator, gas stove. There are not too many that go totally, totally off-grid and disconnect themselves from both gas and electricity.
I know you have written specifically about tiny cabins in the past. This book has a little of everything scale-wise, but I did want to ask you how the world of cabin design has been influenced by this tiny home movement that we're hearing a lot about.
Well, I think the design of cabins arrived at the tiny house movement long before the tiny house movement, and people were building very small cabins and enjoying them. So my first cabin was 14 by 18, and with a little tiny loft, and you know, I wasn't alone. There are certainly other people who have done structures like that. So the tiny house movement is probably a name that really attracts people right now, and it's fascinating. But I think we could learn a lot. The tiny house movement can learn a lot from cabins that have been built for the last 100 years.
There's a cabin in this book for which I think you were the architect up in the Boundary Waters, and I don't know how many square feet it was, but I was just amazed at the use of space.
Now, that cabin is 14 by 27, and then it's got a little additional front entry area and a screen porch in addition to that. So, and then it does have two lofts, one on either end of the gable structure. So I don't know what that totally adds up to in square footage, but probably less than 500 square feet. And yet it serves a family of five.
Wow. There's also a section of this book that features cabins that draw on history, either by repurposing a historic structure from the site or by design that harkens back to historic structures. In some cases, I was looking at this and thinking it's interesting to consider how, you know, say the settlers in a place who built a log cabin out of necessity might view it being used as a getaway.
Yes, I suspect that many of those settlers would be surprised today at our romance and charm of historic log structures. Often those early settlement, or settler, rather, log structures were actually thought to be rather primitive structure even by the users of it, and eventually wanted to clad them over in clapboard or whatever. Today they're being uncovered and repurposed as cabins in the woods, such as the one that I feature that's in the Mark Twain Forest in Missouri. And of course, new structures are being made to emulate older historic structures. One of the older structure types that I've been fascinated with now for a number of years and have featured in a few books that I've done is what I call the porch cabin. It was a cabin back in the turn of the previous century that featured about two-thirds to three-quarters of the cabin was itself screen porch, and then there was a little warm room in the middle if you needed to escape from the cool fresh air. And I believe that the rationale for those cabins historically was that it was intended to take the family out into the rural area for the summer to be in fresh air to ward off those nasty diseases of polio and diphtheria that were plaguing the nation at the time. Over time, those have been retained, or in a few cases, some of them have been filled in a bit as people no longer go to their cabin for the whole of a summer. We have had a few clients here at Saul Architects that have asked, can we have a contemporary screen porch cabin? So we've created a few new ones, they've been a lot of fun to do.
How do you view climate control? Because, I mean, I know spending time in a cabin every summer, one of the beauties of it is that by the end of even, you know, within a couple of days, we sort of lose the ability to tell what's inside and outside. I mean, being sort of really part of the atmosphere and the feeling of the natural environment. And it seems like looking at many of the cabins in this book, that's also a key part of the equation.
I think so. We often do want to add a bit of heat into our cabins for those really cool evenings or cooler subsets of even the summer season. But we don't necessarily need to add air conditioning because we really enjoy the fresh air. And so maybe a few ceiling fans are all we need for when it gets a little too hot. And people really don't want to shut out the noises, whether that, in your case, might have been the noise of the waves of the ocean lapping against the shore, or in the case of inland lakes like we have here in the Midwest, the sound of the loons at night. You don't want to really miss that, so you don't want to really shut that world off. You want to hear the rain and the trees and the sound of the leaves clapping or something in the breeze. I think even if we're indoors and out of the bugs, we want to be able to be connected to the sense of fresh air, the smell of the pine trees and so forth.
So how did this happen to become your specialty? Why did you become a cabinologist versus an officeologist or a ballparkologist or what have you?
Well, I was already working in the sub-industry of residential home design. So then I got a client who asked me to do a cabin, and I realized I didn't know a lot about cabins because I had grown up on a dairy farm. We worked 365 days a year, and we didn't have any time to run off to cabins. So I realized I needed to know something more about it, so I started to research the subject of cabins here in Minnesota and in Wisconsin. And I did that at first with some students, and we were asking the question of, if you went out and saw 10 cabins, which one would feel like it was the quintessential cabin compared to the others, and why? And so if you do that enough times, you begin to gain a feeling of what seems to be the attributes of a cabin. Along the way, then I started writing for local magazines on the subject of cabins, and that led me to a lot of interesting subset questions about how were cabins built. You know, what's the difference between a vertical log cabin and a horizontal log cabin? And the porch cabin came out of that research, and so forth. So I think I just was fascinated by the subject, and then. The other part of it I realized is that nobody was doing it. You know, I was the only one out there sort of trying to uncover these things, and I didn't have a lot of competitors doing it. And so I just kind of filled a void that turned out to be helpful to my professional life.
Does your interaction with clients differ when you're working with them on a cabin versus just a house?
Not dramatically. A lot of the issues are similar. I mean, you're trying to sort out, as a designer, you're trying to make sure that what you're creating for your client is what they want and what they understand. Not every client reads drawings, or, you know, we build a lot of models and today do a lot of computer modeling in order to show clients what they're getting. So I'd say the process isn't dramatically different. I think it's important to be for we designers to be out on the site a lot, because a lot of what we're going to do has to do with the fact that we're fitting it into a unique topography, that the lake view is in the westerly direction, and the sun comes up over here, and the entry is going to be over there. So there's a lot to be learned from being at the site. I think also there's a different set of builders to work with that are out in cabin land. They may be builders who make sure they get 2 weeks off to go hunting every fall. And there may just be other things about the nature of who's out there. And then there are different products available to us or not available to us out in cabin land. So some of the more nuanced, new, sophisticated products may not be available. On the other hand, local trees are being milled, and you can have them made into paneling uniquely for each bedroom in your cabin. So, there are some nuanced differences when it comes to creating a cabin.
Is this a busier time of year for you? Are there people at the end of the summer who really start thinking about the cabin that they want next year?
That's somewhat true. People will come back from their summer at the cabin and be fresh with ideas of wanting the XYZ change before they get back there in the spring. But the other phenomena that has been occurring over the last probably 20 years is that fewer and fewer people are thinking about their cabin for just summer use. They're beginning to think of their cabin throughout the year. So we're doing almost, I would say, 95% of the cabins we do today are really intended for four-season use. So they're well-insulated, can be used in the middle of the winter. We have to think about, are we heating them all the time or totally shutting them down? But generally, it's heating them all year, but, you know, turning the heat down to make sure the pipes don't freeze. So I think that's related to the fact that we no longer, as a society, commonly think of taking 3 weeks off in the summer. Our mom and the kids don't get to go to the cabin for the whole of the summer, but rather we take snippets of time off all year long. And for many of us who have cabins, who use them in the winter, we really enjoy being there in the winter, the quietness of it all, and getting out to cross-country ski or do other winter sports.
Well, Dale Mulfinger, I think you've really whet my appetite anyway. Thank you so much.
Sure, Mitch. Come on over and see some of our Minnesota cabins.
Dale Mulfinger is Principal Emeritus at Sala Architects in Minnesota and author of several books on cabins and cabin design, including his latest, The Family Cabin, Inspiration for Camps, Cottages, and Cabins. He joined us on the line from Minnesota.